Hello and welcome to the Dense City Podcast, a show where we meet with academics to discuss their research on cities. I'm your co-host, Isaac Keast. Today we welcome Dr. Tom Cohen and Mariam Almirwani. Tom is a senior lecturer at the University of Westminster, and Mariam is a graduate engineer. Their joint research on transportation policy explores active transportation and justice, as well as transportation behavior changes. We'll be discussing their article, Addressing the Unjust Treatment of Pedestrians at Signalized Intersections, published in Transportation Research Presidia in 2022. The article is premised on the idea that pedestrians wait statistically longer than other road users at signalized intersections, and that this is unconducive to walkability and an affront to justice. The article explores why traffic signals have this effect and their car-centric origins that prioritize traffic flow at all costs. Years of optimization and increasingly long light signals have exacerbated these wait times and revealed a disconnect between the signal function and the pedestrian experience. Today's article explores who gets counted and who gets prioritized on the road and suggests a more just approach towards signal optimization that enables walkability. Let's get into the article and find out why this is an urban planning problem and how we can make more just intersections. All right, so with that, can I get you to walk us through the purpose of your article?
Sure. Well, maybe I should just start by saying that Mariam and I have worked on this for coming on for 3 years, I think, and have tackled various aspects of it. So the paper that you read, and which I suppose will be the center of our conversation, is one chunk of what we've been doing. So maybe we will talk about other things. But that paper was motivated by the opportunity to present at a conference called Living and Walking in Cities, which takes place every year in Italy. And as the name would suggest, it has a focus upon walking. But the paper comes from frustration at being pedestrian and waiting at a signalized intersection to be allowed to cross. Oh, one other thing which I really ought to say for form's sake is that whenever I talk about walking, I think we should assume that I'm saying walking and wheeling, just for purposes of inclusion.
Of course, yeah.
But it's right that we found common cause, because when Mariam and I first talked about working together, I said, I get really annoyed about how pedestrians have to wait so long at certain junctions. And Mariam said, me too, which is why we ended up working on this particular project together.
I see. And you both are in central London, which, I mean, that's like a world-class city center. So, you know, if you're experiencing it there, you must imagine that this issue can pervade other areas even more when, you know, you would assume London would be quite walkable. So if you're experiencing higher wait times, it's kind of an indication of an issue.
Well, maybe you should talk about a city you know well.
Yeah, well, I think I found the walkability of London more shocking than Tom did, because it was more new to me, coming from a place that wasn't walkable at all. In Saudi Arabia, it wasn't really designed for people to walk around, designed primarily for cars. And then coming to London, I thought I was coming to this metropolis where everyone was free to walk from to their destination. And I found it to be quite the opposite. So when I walk down the street, the number of people that I see crossing on a red light was just shocking to me. The number of junctions that didn't have pedestrian crossings was really surprising. The amount of time I'd spend pressing buttons and waiting to cross the street, it just wasn't as comfortable as I thought it would be for a pedestrian.
The irony for London is that it is, as you say, it's a metropolis, it's an ancient city, and its core is very dense and has narrow roads. So you would have thought that it is very well suited to walking. And to some extent, it is. Better than most. But I suppose that just draws attention, therefore, to its shortcomings. And I ought to say that the intersection which most irritated me was one outside London in a town called Sherburn in Dorset to the south of London, which is a maddening example of everything being configured to suit the driver and the pedestrians being given facilities, but very much the scraps after the important users have been catered for.
I love London, and you're right, it is so suited to walkability just because it is dense and has short blocks and everything. But I was baffled by the number of times I would come across just a metal fence on the edge of the street.
Well, pedestrian safety is the primary concern when talking to pedestrians. They want us not to injure ourselves by doing something as foolish as rushing onto the carriageway. So those fences that you speak of, and they annoy me too, are all about that. Part of the training of the signals highway engineer and the signals engineer is to stop pedestrians from hurting themselves, perhaps at the cost of making them wait a lot.
It's hard to butt up against that argument for safety. when that's the rationale, you can't argue back that you're waiting too long to cross the street because they'll just say, well, you could get hit by a car, which is fair enough.
Yeah, it's true as far as it goes. It's just not sufficiently inclusive in its thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of the things that we had to reconcile in the very beginning. So you have a pedestrian contesting with a big metal box. It's obvious who's going to win that fight.
Right.
So why not just give them more, just give them what they want, basically. But obviously that's not an equitable solution. It's not fair.
Yeah, the fence, it's the easiest solution, right? It's just, let's not have this discussion at all. Build a fence, now no one can do anything. Perfect. Before we move on to some of the literature, can you just summarize for us what you are actually looking at in this article?
It's probably accurate to say that we started with our views on the equity of the situation. And so at first, we're trying to understand what is actually happening. Is our supposition about the treatment of pedestrians accurate? And if so, why might that be? Then to try to work out whether you could do anything about it.
Mm.
So we perhaps proceeded more with the what to do about it. And then in parallel, we're gathering data and analyzing data that enabled us to ascertain the extent to which it is the case that pedestrians wait longer than other users at signalized intersections. And so there was some analysis, and Marion can say something about that because she did that. I don't have the skills. But the literature that we looked at was very much about trying to understand whether there was an acknowledgement amongst researchers and in the practitioner literature as to whether this was the case, and if so, why.
Right.
And then the so what piece, the could you do anything about it, was much more a creative thinking, I suppose, where we imagine a scenario where you insist upon equality, and then you say, well, if that's too much, which it probably is, then what else could you do instead? And that's where we start moving towards concepts such as distributed equality.
Mm.
But maybe you should say something about the analysis you did.
So the analysis that we carried out was, initially it started off as just us trying to see, is this theory that we have, or is this instinct that we have, true? So we started off by modeling different intersections around London and extracting numbers regarding delays and wait times for both pedestrians and vehicles and comparing them against each other. And we did actually find that pedestrians were waiting significantly longer in some junctions. So that was kind of something that sparked the next phase, which was, what do we do about it? Is there something we can do about it?
Mm.
Why is this happening? And just a string of other questions that we are trying to answer.
I know in your method, you break down a number of different points that you go through. Part of it is a literature review. You do an analysis of intersections. Could you walk us through some of the literature that you reviewed to inform the paper?
Happily. Most of the literature we found is academic written, not exclusively, but most of it. And some of it was quite elderly. I did a search broadly on a targeted basis for material that would help to shed light on the questions we were asking. So it wasn't perhaps one of these classically conceived exercises of, I'll read everything there is to read on traffic signals, and then I will extract from that knowledge the reality that we then discovered that pedestrians get a raw deal. It was more that, well, we had a pretty good idea that pedestrians get a raw deal. What can the literature help to shed light on that?
Right.
And there were a variety of things. Really, there were some interesting papers where researchers had studied highway engineers doing their thing. There were one or two projects where attempts had been made to come up with better configurations, a better way of doing it. That was some of the older material. And I suppose on the more practical front, we looked at the instruction manuals for some of these commonly used tools in order to understand what they purported to be able to do and how.
What their minimum prescriptions would be for an intersection, for example.
Oh, yes, sorry, you're right, because that's another chunk of the literature I should have mentioned. I did get hold of various guidance documents, I suppose you would call them, which say these are the circumstances in which you should or you mustn't or you might with regard to introducing signals and having facilities for pedestrians, because as Mariam says, there are plenty of junctions where there's nothing for the pedestrian at all.
Mm.
If you do provide for the pedestrian, what you should or shouldn't do. And I suppose the striking thing there is the literature is quite thin. Not much is said about minima or maxima. It's rather more a matter of use your judgment. And if you do proceed down a certain route, having to make one or two assumptions. But what was glaringly absent was anything that seemed to say pedestrians are a legitimate form of traffic. therefore, alongside every other form of traffic, there is a need to provide for them, and this is how to think about it. That was just not present in the literature that I saw.
Mm. There wasn't much present about pedestrians at all, I imagine, other than in respect to how they affect cars.
Sure. It's certainly very much less researched, as a subsequent query of the literature helped to demonstrate. But yes, we know from the history of transport planning and from highway engineering that pedestrians were never the center. They came to be more and more recognized, but it took time and we've still got a very long way to go.
Which is kind of funny because it was the original, was it not? Like, how did anyone get around before they walked?
Sure, absolutely. And there's some lovely literature that you can read about the origins of walking and celebrating walking. But these are, they feel like quite niche works, not for a second in the core of the transport planning literature.
Right.
I think we also found that most of the documentation we found for policy and best practices focused mainly on comfort, which pertains to provision of facilities rather than wait times or pedestrian delays. So they just focused on whether there is a sidewalk, whether there's a crossing, is there a button accessible, but nothing really focused on the timings or including them in the cycle.
Hmm. Of course, I think we'd all agree the infrastructure provisions are super important as well. I mean, if you're walking on a gravel path and if you're in a wheelchair, I mean, that's almost prohibitive just by itself. So the infrastructure is obviously important, but at the end of the day, if you're sitting on a beautiful sidewalk and you can't cross the street, it's of no help to you. So that's a worthwhile gap to research. Anyways, now I'd like to get into the methodology. So if you'd be able to expand for me on how you actually went about this, how did you pick intersections, for example, and what other methods did you include in this?
So we mentioned in the paper that we had four main elements in our methodology. One was the literature review that Tom mostly covered. And then the second part of it was exploring the different software that were being used in the industry. So for that, we explored three pieces of software. One of them was Junctions 9, Linsig, which I think is the most commonly used one within councils. And then there's Thyssen, which is the one that we decided to go with because it had the most pedestrian parameters that we could play around with, which is what we were looking for. We actually found that the others didn't really provide things like pedestrian headcounts or start and end points or optimized routes for them like Thyssen did.
You mean the software just didn't have mechanisms to include pedestrian measurements?
So it included pedestrian flows. You could model pedestrians, but it didn't really give you any feedback on their experience.
Okay. Were you just studying the software itself or were you using it to model traffic?
So initially we were using the software to model and see what we could do with the software itself because we were trying to find the best state-of-the-art software that's being used. And I think by understanding what can and cannot be done
right
on the software, we could understand how practitioners were thinking when they were modeling.
Yeah, you could understand their constraints a bit better.
Exactly, yeah. So after we'd selected Thyssen as our software, we moved on to modeling some junctions that we managed to get a hold of from TfL. So Transport for London, is they run all of the signals in London and they managed to give us some signal cycles. So we were able to model those. So this was the first step in proving our hypothesis that pedestrians were waiting longer.
Mm.
And then from there, we moved on to our fourth step of the methodology, which was interviewing practitioners, speaking to people in industry, people who are working on, whether privately or in the public sector, on signal timings and junction designs, and trying to get into their heads, understanding how they go about this process, what they prioritize, what they think about, what are their drivers, what are their constraints.
Hmm.
Things like that, just so we could gain an understanding of best practices and current practices.
Best practices, like from an urban planning standpoint?
Yeah, so from a practitioner's point of view, what is their preferred outcome when they're designing a junction? What are they looking for? What are they looking to do?
I guess by a practitioner, do you mean like engineer or urban planner? Because I feel like they'd have two different answers.
You raise a really good question, and it's something which other research I'm aware of has explored, because depending on your disciplinary background, you might have quite a different perspective
right
on what this task actually is.
What achieving it looks like.
Right. As Mariam says, where you're trying to get to. So we spoke, I think, with highways engineers in the majority, but at least one of our conversations was with someone who straddles two camps, is both a highway engineer and perhaps has become more an urban designer in later years. And perhaps his perspective was the most interesting in that he did appreciate some of the issues that we were raising more than the practitioners we spoke to from a more classically engineering background, who were sympathetic to our questions, but seemed not ever to have thought of the things we were asking about.
Every time I talk to an engineer, they have a much more A to B direct answer. They use those guides, like you mentioned earlier, that is usually issued by the government, and it's cut and dry. So their point of view is it's almost always focused on the cars, right? Because at the end of the day, what's going to back up traffic? What's going to cause catastrophic ripple effects? The pedestrians on the sidewalk will make do.
So true, so true.
So section three of your paper, current practice, would you be able to explain to us the current state of traffic management? How did we get here? And I think we already know a bit about what the traffic pattern analysis showed. So how about the traffic management systems that are at play?
Yeah, I would summarize it very simply. The practice is about keeping the traffic moving. And that as a goal, as a norm, seems to drive all before it. If you could mention driving in that way. So the idea of introducing different norms, such as prioritizing pedestrians or giving them an equitable deal, doesn't feature because it's not implicit in the overall mission. The mission is to keep the traffic moving. And so highway engineers are no doubt very good at what they do. They are trying to find a working balance in a situation of scarce resource and high demand. And on the whole, therefore, chipping off little bits of time for one stream of traffic in order to give it to another stream in the hope that that won't lead to some kind of catastrophic consequence, either upstream or downstream. So it's an art, and it seems to be quite a fine art amongst those who do it, but it's quite narrowly defined. And I hesitate to criticize engineers. Engineers can do fantastic work. I suppose the trite cliche would be, it's about the question you ask the engineer. You ask them a good question, you'll get a good answer. And maybe our general finding would be that in terms of highway engineering, at least, there are problems with the question, not with the execution that is carried out in response to it. Would you agree with that, or would you take a different line?
I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head with their main job is to keep traffic flowing, and that's their main concern.
There is the secondary issue of safety. They clearly want not to be responsible for someone being hurt. And as a consequence, to the extent that they worry about pedestrians, it is in terms of level of jaywalking, i.e. whether anything that they've done has led more people to take a chance in crossing rather than waiting for a green signal. And I suppose it has to be said also that everybody working in this field is somewhat wary of being the subject of litigation. You don't want to be the person who did whatever it was that led to the court case that led to a guilty verdict of some sort. So there's a tendency to be somewhat risk averse, I think, as a result.
No better illustration, I think, of that is that some of the real remaining walkable places, those really walkable neighborhoods that we all know and love exist, and they're very, very old. They don't get built like that anymore. I think no one would take that burden of litigation risk. If you took a traffic engineer and walked them around like the Gothic quarter of Barcelona, say, I mean, their brain would just be going crazy with the infractions. There's no space for anything. So I understand why they get made like that now. It's just a shame there's so many rules.
Sure. And you see it in other areas of life. We have this vexed subject, shared space is a type of scheme which was popular for a while, but is now not popular because of the number of people who objected to the idea of pedestrians and motorized vehicles sharing space without much in the way of rules concerning should do what where. And your example of Barcelona is a good one in that those are places that are naturally very informal. It's inimical to anyone who is wary of being caught out, being the person who failed to provide whatever it might be, tactile paving in the required location.
Informal is exactly the problem, because making these new places, well, when they get made, they're formal. Those places can kind of exist the way they do because they were always like that. So they're just kind of grandfathered in, and they have that negotiation that constantly takes place in that the space gets shared.
Well, I think you could say that new developments can have that character, but they're rare, and they are pockets of informality where the general rules in the surrounding area will remain as we're coming to expect them. the law of the jungle applies.
You're right. They are slowly kind of moving in that direction again. I live in Canada, and that development is pretty rare here. They're still building single family home suburbs everywhere. I lived in Toronto for 4 years, and Toronto got a woo nerf. Are you familiar with the term?
Yeah, the home zone, as we tend to call them.
Yeah, yeah. So Toronto got one street in the whole city, and they've still just got the one.
Similar story in the UK. There was a little flurry of experiments with home zones, and the results were quite encouraging, but they were expensive to deliver. And I think you can't get past the fact that they remain these little islands where the rules are different.
Yeah.
But elsewhere, it's business as usual.
I guess another important aspect of the current practice is that cars and vehicular traffic have more of a monetary value than people or pedestrians walking. So you benefit more as a city or as a council from having cars than you would by taking them out.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I remember you mentioned this in the paper, actually, that you can also just kind of make the assumption that anyone driving a car has more money than someone who doesn't. I mean, that could be a very terribly wrong assumption, but you could make that assumption and be right a lot of the time as well. And I think that's probably what councils and shop owners think, is that people driving will spend more money.
Mm.
But people driving have to find parking. I never see how that argument works out.
Yeah, the evidence seems to point the other way, but that doesn't change the fact that the orthodoxy is to assume that the car driver has a greater right or a more important reason to be doing what they're doing.
Yeah, and like I already said, their car is just big. So if it doesn't move, it's going to be blocking something. All right, so I guess now let's get into some of the takeaways from the paper. What are some of the things that we can glean from this paper that can be done to make this situation a little bit more equitable?
Very interesting question. We struggled a lot with defining what equality was or equity was on the road.
Yeah, then just talk about your struggle, I guess, or what you were torn between.
Sure. Okay, so we got a little bit philosophical at this point and started saying, well, suppose you set out some essential propositions. No one likes to wait.
Right.
And if there's no particular reason for preferring one category of traveler to another, then it seems to follow that no one should wait any longer than anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt that that was a reasonably robust conclusion to draw from very simple premises that would be difficult to argue with, we thought. That's fine as far as it goes, but you're left in a sort of philosophical quandary, because the implication would appear to be, right, well, then we have to rip up the current arrangements and start insisting that at any intersection, the delay is evenly distributed. So whatever type of traffic you are, be you a pedestrian or a driver, you wait the same length of time. And going back to what we said a moment ago about the job of the highway engineer, that would be highly disruptive because, of course, they are juggling the demands of a vehicle-dominated network.
Mm.
And they're giving pedestrians little time, not because of a particular dislike of pedestrians, or at least we didn't get the impression that that was what was in their minds, but because that was a natural consequence of keeping the traffic moving.
Right.
If you have a dominant mode, and it would go the same in the opposite direction. You know, if pedestrians were a great deal more numerous than anybody else, then you can see how other types of traffic would, on that way of doing things, wait disproportionately. So we say, okay, suppose you insist on equality, you probably get a mess. How helpful is that likely to be? Not very.
Mm.
What else might you do instead? And that leads in two directions. One direction is the, you could describe as the easy way out, which is to say, right, well, pedestrians should never have to wait more than X. Stipulate a maximum on the basis that anything more would be inhumane or unacceptable. And we found that there were cities that were doing that. But it felt to me like a cop-out, because what is that threshold? And why should that threshold be acceptable? Why shouldn't half of that threshold be acceptable?
Mm.
Which leads to something which continues to be an idea that we want to test. We haven't had a chance to do so yet, but the idea of distributed equality, and that is over a network where there are many intersections, you might say that on certain of them, it is acceptable to give more green time to vehicles and therefore make pedestrians wait more, provided that elsewhere in the network, the opposite happens, with the effect that overall, there's balance. So you don't have equality at any individual intersection particularly, but over a set of intersections that in combination make up an urban area, pedestrians are getting a fair deal compared with other road users in aggregate, if you like. And it's an idea which we have discussed with practitioners, and there's some interest in it. though it's fair to say that I've never had research budget for this work, so it's something that I've been doing for love. And Mariam has been doing it out of, I don't know, an enthusiasm for the subject and equally passionate about the yeah, there you go.
Interest and passion.
There you go, passion and interest. So it remains something that we do in our spare time rather than something that we've got a big fat grant to pay for, which helps to explain why the progress has been slow. But at some point, we will get a chance to test this idea of distributed equality to see whether you can pull it off and avoid irritating stakeholders who are very interested in traffic flow at the same time as achieving this aim of giving everybody a fair go.
Yeah, I feel like spending enough time waiting at a red man is enough inspiration to start doing this research.
Well, I think that's probably true. And I'm just amazed that I don't come across more people who are up in arms at this situation.
Yeah, that's part of the reason I do this podcast is exactly that. Like, I walk around my city every day and I notice things and I want to talk about them. When I talk to my friends who aren't in this industry or research space, it's often never crossed people's minds. So it's kind of like this treatment of pedestrians gets away unnoticed. And because anyone who's a driver only interacts with these signals after they've parked or something, it's usually only once or twice a day. So, you know, it's enough to be overlooked.
I think there's a wider point, which is that we live in these cities all the time and so become blind to their characteristics, things which if we were to see them for the first time, we might query them. Mm. They're so familiar that we just walk past them without thinking. A point that we make in the paper is it's so obvious and yet it's easily overlooked is why is it that pedestrians have to press a button in order to be granted the opportunity to cross? And there's a cartoon that you see where a driver is having to reach out in order to do that. And it's a powerful cartoon because, of course, it's such an unthinkable scenario.
I'm going to get that cartoon to post on our Instagram for this episode. There's a story I remember when I was in urban planning school in Toronto just a few years ago. My friend and I took a train down to Niagara Falls and we got out of the train station and we walked to the street and it was a red light and we were waiting and the green light went. And the pedestrian light stayed red. And I looked at her and I was like, what the hell? And we were baffled. And then we looked and like 10 meters away, there was a button and it was a snowstorm. And we had to like trudge over to this button. And we were taking the train from Toronto where you don't need to press a button. So we just didn't think about it. But that was a perfect illustration to me of like, geez, why do we make people live like that? I also want to talk a little bit about profound network changes that you talk about in your takeaways. You talk about the removal of signals as a possibility as well. How would that be explored? And do you think that would be potentially beneficial for pedestrians, less traffic signals?
Well, yes, possibly. One removes traffic signals with care and certainly not lightly because they're generally there. It having been demonstrated that they are preferable to their absence.
Mm. Yeah, I guess.
They are regulating something that would otherwise be less efficient. Funny thing being that roundabouts are on the whole a much more efficient way of handling traffic than signalized intersections, except for the fact that they're even worse for pedestrians than signalized intersections. So we certainly don't want to recommend that route from a walking perspective. But if the case for a signalized intersection is not cut and dried, then removing it and putting zebra crossings in is manifestly preferable because the rules for a zebra crossing in the UK, at least, are that the pedestrian has the right of way.
Mm.
That's not how road users behave in this country.
Oh, yeah, same here.
Nevertheless, that is the rule. So at least in principle, a zebra crossing gives a pedestrian instant right of crossing. No having to wait, no having to nod or it. But again, what we see is people waiting politely, hoping that the drivers will stop for them.
Yeah.
And often breaking into a run when they are yielded to, because obviously this driver has a very important journey. I'm just in the way.
Nothing breaks my heart more than when I see a child or an elderly person have to hurry up to cross the street, and kids will just break out into a sprint as soon as they touch the pavement. And I guess they've probably been told to do that by their parents, but it's just kind of sad that that's the state of the street.
Yeah, again, I think it's just one of these. We don't see it because it's so quotidian.
Exactly. Yeah.
So one of the other things we mentioned was the idea of crossing on right. This idea that, well, at the moment in the UK, at least, it would be left turning traffic in this country. It's very common in other countries where vehicles don't have to wait, they can proceed, but they would have to yield if someone were crossing on the sidearm that they were turning into. In the UK, that's not the case, which is why there are more phases in the typical cycle, and sorry, more stages, to use the right term, in the typical signal cycle, and the capacity of intersections is somewhat reduced. So one of the people we spoke to was talking about how there were benefits to be had from allowing this practice, which is very common in the States, I think.
It's common in Canada too. It's right on red.
You call it, sorry?
Right on red.
Right on red. So did I get that?
I think they introduced the first green man pedestrian crossing in Saudi in 2018. So
okay, we've got some work to do. Got some work to do.
Give us a few years, we'll catch up eventually.
Right. So this is interesting because it goes to the heart of this safety debate. It would be anathema in the UK because, of course, we don't want for a second to create a situation where the pedestrian is exposed to the risk of being struck by a vehicle. And so that's why at our signalized intersections, that's not allowed. But there is a long history of it working reasonably well in other places and some efficiency benefits resulting.
Yeah, it's legal all over Canada, except for in one city. It's not allowed in Montreal. I personally prefer the way Britain does it. I wish it wasn't allowed here because it does incentivize people to pull up at the intersection, look to see if any cars are coming, and then if not, go. And most people don't give cyclists on their right-hand side or pedestrians any thought. And I've seen it happen way too often that people just, they don't even stop. They just speed right through it. So it really does put in people's mind that they can just go. They treat it like a green light. So yeah, it's part of that car brain that I don't think should be incentivized.
Sure. And I suppose that's the thing to say about these various alternatives is that we put them in perhaps more for completeness than out of any strong notion that they were good ideas. They're just
right
alongside our rather doctrinaire approach to reconfiguring traffic signals. You should ask the wider question of, well, do we have the right thing in there to begin with? And I suppose if you were to talk even more broadly, we could talk about banning vehicles from large sections of cities. It would seem remiss to allow a conversation like this to go past without mentioning low traffic neighborhoods. You come across these, Isaac.
In Toronto, we had something called slow streets where like cars could only go one block. Is it anything like that?
Sounds similar.
Okay.
So the fundamental idea of a low traffic neighborhood is that it discourages through movements and forces traffic onto so-called boundary roads.
Sort of like a super block?
Yeah, very much the same idea. Yeah. And they are very common now. I say very common. There have been a lot of them put in the UK. They have proved very controversial. But in terms of sorts of things you could do, they're definitely part of the transport planning armory. Not necessarily that relevant to our inquiry because it's on the busier roads that you need facilities for pedestrians to cross. So low traffic neighborhoods wouldn't necessarily contribute very much to what we're trying to do. But it's this idea of having a wider set of tools in consideration before settling on perhaps something quite radical in terms of the timings of traffic signals.
Right. And you mentioned something earlier that I want to go back to. You said that roundabouts pose some problems for pedestrians. Could you touch on what some of those are? I know that's outside of the scope of the paper, but if you have any insight, I'd still love to hear about that.
Sure. Well, to the extent that I know about these things, and I suppose I should say I'm not a traffic engineer. Maybe we should have outed ourselves at the beginning. I'm not a traffic engineer. Yeah, roundabouts succeed from a traffic perspective by providing vehicles with a smooth path. So no sharp turns, which is a good thing in terms of reducing delay. But the quid pro quo is that that means the approach and exit lanes of roundabouts tend to be wide and fast moving, i.e. very difficult to provide for pedestrians. If you introduce signals, then you're to a considerable extent undoing the efficiency benefits that you've just got yourself by putting the roundabout in.
Right.
One should say, of course, the Netherlands is way ahead of us in this regard and has introduced a variety of roundabout designs that are safe for cycling. These Dutch roundabouts are great for cycling at the expense of the driver who has to give way more than would be the case otherwise. And I suppose that's the point. You can make roundabouts successful for pedestrians, but at the cost of making them slower for the driver, thereby eroding their apparent benefits as compared with signalized intersections.
On the topic of Dutch roundabouts, one thing they pay attention to that is so frequently overlooked in North America, at least, is the grades at which people are actually at. They do a good job of moving the cars up to the pedestrian and cyclist level instead of dropping cyclists and pedestrians down to the car level. It just makes everyone feel so much more seen. So the pavement is just such an unforgiving place. So I'd rather not have to share it with the cars. On the topic of roundabouts, pedestrian diversions are also inevitable with roundabouts, right? Because they usually have to go to the pinch point where the street connects. You can't cross right in the middle, or often right where the sidewalk ends, you need to meander to the corner. That's something I find it was completely overlooked with a lot of those roundabouts. And if you've ever walked in Barcelona, the kind of cornered blocks in Barcelona, and you have to always walk up to get to the crosswalk. And it's just such a clear example, I feel like, of a disconnect between traffic planners and actual pedestrians.
I'm with you. Yeah, I think we're talking about the area at Champlain. Is that right?
Exactly.
These chamfered blocks, which I think are beloved of architects.
Oh, totally.
But yes, agreed.
Certain parts of Champlain are actually much better now. They've made it pedestrian friendly so that they can walk anywhere they like in the area. But in some of the parts, it's still just parking on those corners. And I don't know, for such a tight city center neighborhood, it's just such a funny thing to overlook, I find.
You're saying that reminds me that we ought to identify signalized intersections, very often introduce very considerable inconvenience for those walking, in terms of insisting that you cross an arm in two stages, for example.
Mm.
So it's exceptionally rare for the pedestrian path to be consistent with the desire line. Some kind of diversion is almost inevitable, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think we found, especially when we were modeling a big, so we tried to see how long it would take a pedestrian to get from start to end and compare that to a car getting from A to B. And we found that because pedestrians had to, for example, go through staggered crossings or walk around the sheep pens, it just took a significantly longer amount of time to get to where they wanted.
Mm. Wait, what was that term you just said? Walk around the...
Oh, sheep pens. Sorry, I picked that term up from Tom.
What does that mean?
The gates that they have to keep pedestrians safe.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
To London's credit, they've actually largely been removed from this city, but they're still very much around. The idea that you marshal your pedestrian, you send them into the centre of the road, and they're on a median strip. But if they were on the median strip, then they might spill onto the carriageway, and that would be terrible. So we force them into these, they're genuinely called sheep pens. I don't know whether they're officially known as sheep pens, but that's how they're referred to by practitioners. You contain them with guardrails on either side, and funnel them through to the next point at which they will be taking their chances with the traffic. One strength of those sheep pens is they're great for locking bicycles too, which is not to be sniffed at because there's a general lack of cycle parking.
Right.
So whilst I celebrated the removal of guard railing in London, there was a slight piquant for me because I realised I would find it more difficult to secure my bicycle. A small price to pay, shall we say.
I didn't even think about that, though. That is its own struggle.
But what Marion alluded to there is perhaps worth mentioning, because in a subsequent piece of work, we looked beyond individual intersections and started looking at a network view of the delay experienced by different users. So maybe say a bit about the modelling that we did of that chunk of the City of London.
Yes. So we managed to get a hold of a ready model of the City of London. Actually, something worth mentioning was the first thing we noticed when we looked at the model was that they didn't have sidewalks in their model itself. So I had to add them in manually.
Hmm. That's telling.
Yeah, pretty telling of how much they value modelling pedestrians in the network itself. And it was quite a big section. I think it had four or five intersections in it. But we used that to model things like understanding start and end points for pedestrians, seeing how long it would take them, understanding how accessible it would be for them to get to their destination.
But it's interesting what Mariam says about having to model, having to create a sidewalk network. We should just acknowledge that there are some different terms floating around. In the UK, we use the word pavement to describe what might be called sidewalk, but the official term is footway, just to confuse things slightly further.
Oh, I thought it was footpath.
Yeah, footpath is something else, right? Ridiculously. Right. And equally, what I think you've been referring to as pavement, I would call carriageway, which is where you find the vehicles, right?
Yes, I did call that the pavement. That is what I would typically call the pavement, funny enough.
And no one would criticize you for it, but this is the thing where you're divided by a common language and all that.
Yeah.
So yes, the pavement is the conventional way of referring to the facilities to the side of the carriageway where walking and wheeling can take place. But it's telling, right? Because VISM is this quite powerful software which was used to create this model, but it had been used largely to develop the network for motorized traffic. Pedestrians featured, but not as fully as they could. Mm. And for us to be able to make these comparisons, Mariam had to do quite a lot of additional coding. Mm. And again, this is in the City of London, which is, relatively speaking, a very enlightened authority, has been working really hard to improve conditions for walking.
Yeah, the City of London is, it's so old, right? They have no extra space. They can't manufacture any more space to work with at this point. So it's really fascinating to see what they come up with. It seems like they're moving in the right direction. I mean, the pedestrian realm is improving every time I visit. So, you know, I'm optimistic, at least. You live there, I guess you'd have a better understanding of how it actually is.
I think it's because London is such a big city and it's managed by different boroughs. So it's a very big difference between how some boroughs manage it. A place like the City of London, for example, obviously they have a higher budget and they're able to put more work into it. They prioritize different things to other boroughs.
Right.
So my everyday experience, for example, I would much rather take the bus than walk, because even though it's the same distance, it's obviously much faster. And I'd spend most of my time standing rather than walking if I were to not take the bus. Mm. But in other boroughs, the situation is a bit different.
Yes. Again, possibly a clarification that we need to make. The maddening terminology of London. So London is a city and it has 33 authorities, one of which is the City of London.
Yes.
The Corporation of London. And it governs the so-called square mile, which is where the financial services are centred. And it's unique in that it has a tiny population, but it has a huge working population, people who come in Monday to Friday for jobs mainly in finance. And as you say, there's no room. So their enlightened status is to some extent just the reality of realizing that you can't allow any more vehicles in. There's no space. Mm. Hence, an emphasis on providing for other ways of traveling. Nevertheless, we found that despite this, even this part of the world has a less benign environment for pedestrians than you might wish, in that pedestrians are being delayed for a longer period than their driving counterpart, making the same end-to-end journeys, the same A to B journeys through the system.
That is a good point that, of course, the City of London might be a little bit more advanced than a more suburban borough in terms of pedestrian amenities. Did you notice any trends when examining the existing traffic lights that suburban boroughs or traffic lights further from the city center, say, had a longer wait time for pedestrians, or was there any sort of correlation there with surrounding neighborhood qualities?
We didn't get a chance because we only had a very small sample of data, alas. So a job that it would be really interesting to do would be to understand whether that supposition is accurate. I think it probably is. And there's much in the paper, but it is only a hypothesis because it's not something we've been able to test. There's also the point that Mariam made, which is that authorities differ in their outlooks and their preferences. So in some parts of London, there's a very clear preference for motorised traffic. Most obvious in the lack of facilities for cycling, but it will also be seen in terms of what it's like to be a pedestrian there.
Yeah, you can tell when you've crossed a borough line and when you're on your bike and they don't want cyclists.
Yeah, I think another point to add to that is that, well, we definitely need to explore different boroughs of London, because one thing that also significantly changes between them is demand, which is the main thing that city planners use to determine who gets what most of the time. Mm-hmm. So in these areas, there is very, very high traffic demand. I think we modelled one of the junctions in Bishopsgate and we tried to adjust the signal timings and we just got complete gridlock. The volume of traffic was incredibly high.
Right.
So it would be really interesting to test the same theory or test our hypothesis on a network, a different network with a different volume of traffic and a different volume of pedestrians. And I think at the end of the day, all of this goes back to the culture and what's already there. Because if, for as long as cars have more signal times, there is going to be a higher volume of vehicles than there are pedestrians, because it's a hostile environment for people to walk in. And until that changes, the culture will follow.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's spot on. And I suppose it goes to the core of our paper, which is fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't ask the question, is this the world we want? Do we want to have the levels of car traffic that we have? We're talking about questions of justice given that status quo, but it's legitimate to ask whether, in fact, we want there to be rather less traffic and a rather more benign environment for walking, which I think most, let's not assume, maybe many of your listeners would assume is a good thing.
Yeah, thank you, Mariam, for pointing that out, because I remembered in your paper, you do say the existing system sort of incentivizes the status quo to continue, because when the pedestrians don't have a reasonable walk time, they have no incentive to walk. They'll be standing there thinking, I'm driving tomorrow.
That serves the vehicle, and therefore people will choose to take that route rather than walking.
Yeah, yeah, it's like the same way a lane on a highway makes more people buy cars and drive.
Yeah.
And that kind of, the more we give in to drivers, the more we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot. Like you said, you were trying to measure traffic signal times and the intersection was just full of traffic the whole time. You know, I sometimes wonder if vehicle traffic can ever be optimized. We always have so much wasted time, it seems, when vehicular transit happens. I mean, if it isn't just human error, it's general lack of space for all the space it takes up.
I think that's the case where Tom spoke about distributed equality, which is distributing time over an entire network. And I think this is a situation where that would be very applicable, because in this case, you'd give more time to vehicles. And then in another neighboring junction, you'd give it to pedestrians and encourage them to take that route instead.
Right.
As to the more philosophical element of your question about, is optimization possible? Well, I suppose there's first the question of what do we mean by optimum? And we could have an 8-hour podcast on that alone. But then I think, as Mariam indicates, some of the time one only dreams of optima, because the reality is the intersection is clogged and you're going to make marginal changes this way or that in order to try to make things work slightly better than they were, or to try to deal with an expected increase in flow because of a development over here, say. So talk of optima, I think, probably lives more in textbooks than in the reality of the typical signals engineer who doesn't have that luxury.
Mm.
Having said that, it is worth saying that one of our conversations, which was with Transport for London, revealed an understandable preference to keep buses moving in particular. And it makes sense, because they're highly efficient ways of moving people around. As Mariam says, they're quicker than walking much of the time. But leave that aside, there's the fact that they can accommodate lots of people in a relatively small space compared with your average private vehicle, which is not space efficient by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
So you could start talking about conceiving of optima on the basis of, well, how much network space or network resource are you consuming per meaningful passenger kilometer, say, as a measure of interest. And then based on that, you can say, okay, we'll start carving things up on the basis of that and see where that takes us.
Mm.
And this would be rather more radical than what we suggested in our paper, because that's suggesting pursuing a particular policy goal, perhaps trying to be most efficient rather than just trying to be equitable in sharing something out between two user groups, where at the moment what we're saying doesn't really get to the heart of whether either group is more deserving than the other. It's just saying, you know, that no one likes to wait, so why should they wait longer than these other people?
That's an easier battle to fight, I think.
Perhaps.
Get less people mad at you.
Maybe.
You'd be surprised.
When it comes to, well, you know, the war on cars, people are very nervous these days. Everybody wants to lose their automobiles. That question about optimization of vehicle traffic, that came to my head mainly because I was staying at an intersection the other day, and, you know, it was green one way, red the other, and no cars could go through the intersection because it was jammed the other way. And yet I still had to wait for some reason to cross the street. And I was like, none of these cars can go anywhere, but for some reason, my walk signal won't turn. You know, it's just because I didn't hit the button in time. I just missed it. And that's why I was like, what's the point of even doing all this for the cars? They can't even go anywhere. Like, I feel like we could, if we just optimize it for pedestrians, the cars would end up getting where they needed to anyways.
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah. I don't care.
That prompts me to give a nod to some of the increasingly clever tech which is emerging. So signals which sense the approach of a pedestrian and introduce a crossing phase as a consequence, so removing the need to request. So these sorts of things are happening in parallel with the sorts of inquiry that we've been conducting, you know, making the situation marginally better for walkers.
That equal wait time distribution aspect that you mentioned you want to look more into, that is an interesting approach, because I think we all would agree there are some intersections that really don't see any pedestrians at all. And, you know, this doesn't matter too much to those. And then others where it's more 50-50 and it needs to be more equitable. So I think that's, you know, a really rational approach. All right. So tell us a little bit about where you see this research going next and how the pedestrian experience might be improved at the intersection, or what things are worth exploring.
Well, maybe I'll mention a paper that we gave last year, and this was at a conference in November, and we're just waiting for the resultant publication, which for some reason seems to be stuck in the works. But that moves on a little bit from the work that we did, that we've been talking about up to now, and asks the broader question about making pedestrians more visible to policymakers and trying to provide more objective measures of the relative quality of experience of different types of road user. This turns on the idea of level of service measurement, which is quite an interesting area of transport. Reasonably rich, not as sophisticated as it might be, and we found tending to go in a direction which doesn't help this intermodal comparison, which we think is so desirable. So we've just done a bit of work. And in fact, what Mariam said about looking at a network area rather than individual intersections was motivated by the same inquiry, understanding more fully the experience of walkers versus other road users. Mm. So we've done a bit of work on that, and that's an ongoing line of activity, which time and money permitting, we'll do more on. But I suppose one of the more interesting outputs was a rather provocative idea concerning reference speed. I'll try to explain this in a way that's understandable, which may be difficult because I don't tend to do a very good job of explaining anything, but let's have a go.
Why not?
So level of service tends to be rather complex. It is at bottom, however, an attempt to explain in relative terms how good a particular mode's experience is. So if you give the pedestrian experience F, you're saying that pedestrians are getting a pretty rotten deal relative to the ideal.
Right.
And if you give pedestrians A, you're saying it's about as good as it could be. And A to F is a consistent scoring system which is used across modes. And we're saying that we want those A's to be meaningful and to have the same meaning for whichever mode. So A is as good as it could be for pedestrians and drivers and cyclists. To do that actually requires you to strip the measure right down to its bare essentials. And we've suggested that one way of doing that would be to say, okay, let's look at the actual speed of travel by mode and compare it with a reference speed, an ideal speed, if you will. And that's well defined in terms of driving. It's always the free flow speed, i.e. if there were no obstacles, no other traffic, how quickly could you travel given the environment?
The speed limit?
Well, yes, but funnily enough, actually free flow speed tends to be defined without reference.
Oh, okay. So it could be well higher than that.
Yeah, some people might be driving more quickly. So free flow speed will generally be calculated based on low traffic conditions. Mm. You'd like to think that it will reflect the posted speed limit because how many people are going to flout it. Meanwhile, the ideal, in inverted commas, speed for walking is walking speed.
Is that right?
Yeah, so on the face of it, that makes sense because that's how fast people walk, right? But I say, well, put that idea to the test. If there was nothing stopping me from running, i.e. if I wasn't going to get tired by running and I could run without hazarding my health or anything like that, then I presumably would run. Why would I choose to travel more slowly than I could travel? So why not make running the reference speed for calculating the pedestrian level service? And as I say, it's provocative. It requires a little thought. And at a thought at first blush, people will say, that's crazy. Maybe it is. It may not actually stand up to scrutiny, but the reason for proposing it is not so much because we're sure it's right, but in order to pose the question, if we're going to make fair intermodal comparisons, we need to be clear as to how we are calculating our various measures and whether we're doing so in a way which is fair and consistent. Mm. It's an ongoing piece of work. We'll spend more time on it when we can.
That A to F grade, is that a grade on the level of service you were talking about?
Correct.
That makes a lot of sense. What's an A for a car? It's almost an inverse relationship with what would be an A for a pedestrian. They value completely different things in a road.
Well, you raise a good point. And what I said about stripping the measures down to the bare essentials does make this quite difficult because the modes are quite different from each other. Mm-hmm. And that's why so-called multimodal levels of service measures have tended to become very mode specific and quite sophisticated, but therefore rather less easy to compare with one another. And I'm suggesting, well, you go in the opposite direction specifically to facilitate comparison. And that requires you to do some strange things, to cast aside various considerations. But it's not as if everybody who walks is really enjoying the experience and just wants to linger indefinitely.
Yeah.
What we see is that people don't want to wait at zebra crossings. They don't want to wait at signalized crossings. They want to get where they're going. Much walking is recreational, and therefore there isn't a desperate rush to get somewhere. But an awful lot of walking is about reaching your destination. no more want to be delayed doing it than the driver wants to be. I think talking about practical speed versus some ideal speed is a meaningful thing to say about walking. It's just then a case of, well, choose the speed. You could, of course, talk about the same reference speed applying to all modes. Why not? Why should we assume that vehicles have a right to expect a higher speed than walkers? Don't see why they should. But that would lead you in some very strange policy directions. All of this is by the by. The ultimate purpose of it is to make explicit for policymakers the true experience of walking compared with other modes.
Right.
You know, we get these arbitrary grades. Oh, pedestrians get a B. Oh, that's fine. But that might be a B based on some quite circular ways of calculating level of service.
Mm-hmm.
My suspicion is that if you went with one of these from first principles approaches, it would become apparent quite quickly that pedestrians get a raw deal compared with drivers.
Right.
And then you would have something to put before a policymaker. Look, drivers are getting A, pedestrians are consistently getting F. Don't we need to do something about that? That's the theory. What is measured is managed is the adage.
When you said that Transport for London actually gave you some of their intersection data, I was like, wow, they're just telling on themselves. I wonder if they've even looked at the data and they know that the pedestrians wait longer.
I think they do know, but they've got various fish to fry. They've got to get buses them.
Yeah.
Like everybody else, they know that gridlock is bad for morale, bad for any number of things. So on the whole, causing vehicles to stand still isn't especially desirable. Transport for London are juggling various balls, and I don't think they shared with us anything that they couldn't or shouldn't have. Not sure. I think it probably would be in the public domain, or it would be possible to obtain it through something like freedom of information request if need be.
If you had asked me before today, I would have said Transport for London was only in charge of the tube. That's all I thought that they did. You're right. Various balls to juggle then.
That's right. Well, they run most of the public transport, but they also are responsible for a substantial part of the road network. And they hand substantial chunks of money to the boroughs that do various works within their road system. So yeah, Transport for London is a very major player in London.
Well, yeah, after this conversation, I mean, we kind of touched on a couple of philosophical points, and I think this whole topic really opens the door to how space is distributed in cities in general and kind of what justice in terms of space distribution looks like. So I'm so interested in your research because of this, and it was even more interesting to talk about. So thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's been a pleasure, Isaac. Nice to meet you.
That's all for now. I really hope you enjoyed. A big thanks to Dr. Tom Cohen and Maryam Almirwani for joining us on the show today. To read the paper we spoke about and to learn more about their work, see the links in the show notes. Please give us a review to let us know what you think of the show and share it if you know someone who might like to listen. To keep the conversation going and for updates on new episodes, follow us at DenseCityPod on Instagram and Twitter and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening right now. A special thanks to Emily Wang of Emily H. Illustrations for creating the artwork for this podcast. You can see more of her work by following the link in the show notes. Thanks as well to Reed Kai and Ryan Kinnear for the show music. See you next time on Dense City.